another edition of Between the Covers, a literature quickie on your community radio station with your host, Tofu Dave. Here again with Sarah McNamara and her new book, Ybor City, Crucible of the Latina South. Sarah, are you on the line?
I am. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Wonderful to talk to you all the way from, I guess you're in Texas at A&M. Your book is so interesting, and, you know, I've been to Cuba, and I like a good Cuban cigar, and that's sort of where your book starts. Why don't you give us an overview?
Absolutely. So my book, Ybor City, it's a story of three generations of Latinas as well as Latinos who live in this community. It's located on the eastern outskirts of Tampa. So I'm talking about the Gulf Coast of Florida. And it tells the story both of a city and a community, as well as how the politics and the ideas of people who live in it change over time as they figure out how to navigate living in a state that is a southern state with evolving Jim Crow politics and what it means to be somebody of Cuban, who is either a Cuban immigrant or of Cuban descent, living in this community as they figure out how to make choices to survive, to make sure that they have living wages, to navigate difficult politics, and eventually to figure out how to get political representation. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking it's so interesting because these days we think of Cuba in terms of Fidel Castro and sort of socialism and communism and all of these kinds of issues. But your story really started at around 1899, if I remember correctly, when some of the cigar factories, if I recall right, started to move into Florida, and then more so towards into the 1900s, 1930s. I know your grandmother, your great-grandmother, some of them worked in the cigar-making industry. And, of course, people have heard of the Tampa cigar, but I had never heard before of Ybor City, which, incidentally, for listeners, is Y-B-O-R, Ybor City, Crucible of the Latina South by Sarah McNamara. But I never realized there was this whole city that was filled way back, you know, 100 years ago with Cuban cigar makers. Tell us a little about that.
Absolutely. So my book, it actually reaches a bit farther back. It begins in the 1880s. So the advent of, we oftentimes, exactly what you said, when we imagine what it means to be Cuban American and from Florida or Cuban American and living in the United States, we readily associate that history with Fidel Castro, with the Castro Revolution, and with Cold War policies. But the reality of Cuban diasporas in the United States is that there are multiple. There are about five different waves that have happened over the course of U.S. history in terms of migration to the United States. Mm-hmm. However, in my book, I focus on one of the first. So the first generation of Cubans to come to Florida came in search of work. And initially, in the midst of the turmoil of Cuba seeking to become an independent nation, right, to separate from Spain during the late 19th century, one of the realities was that there was a very unstable economic situation. And Cuban cigar manufacturers specifically were looking for ways in order for their enterprises to survive. And there's two different factors to this. One of the realities is that there were very high tariffs on the island of Cuba for export of manufactured goods. So many of these, you know, elite people, they supported separation from Spain, regardless of whether or not they were technically of Spanish descent and living in Cuba, because there was an economic benefit for them to do so. But, right, that ends people in a rather sticky situation, especially politically, as Spain, you know, works to harness political control over the island in the midst of independence movements. So different cigar manufacturers, some go to New York, but a hefty number go to Key West initially. Mm-hmm. And in Key West, what ends up happening is that people import the raw good, right? So they're importing Cuban tobacco, which cannot be grown in the United States. They have tried it. You cannot grow the variety in the U.S. But U.S. tobacco does not make as high quality of a product. So they import Cuban tobacco, and they also attract workers to come and work in the southern tip of Florida, right, as close as you could be to the island. Over time, manufacturers start to believe that part of the issue that they have with labor control, because labor unionism is a, you know, cross-border, a transnational factor for those who are living in Key West. And one manufacturer, Vicente Martinez Ybor, seeks to figure out a way to control his labor force. So he starts looking for a place to relocate his cigar manufacturing enterprise and lands on Tampa. Tampa, at the turn of the century, there was basically nobody living here, right? So you're looking at the 1880s. There's roughly 700 people who are living in Tampa Bay, the entire area. It is most rooted as a former military base that was barely operational. And Ybor, when he comes to Tampa, he buys a large tract of land on the eastern outskirts of the city. And it is, at least at first, an independent city. There is another investor as well. His last name is Aya. And the two of them build the first factories here. But over time, what happens is that both due to Tampa's location, right, you're able to get direct import of tobacco as well. But they offer things like housing that at first you can buy rather affordably. So people who are working class become owners, right? They become homeowners, or at least initially. There are benefits to working in Florida that they didn't necessarily have, right, on the island or in Havana. It also offers security. It offers higher wages. These things are attracting people to come to Florida and to come to the Gulf Coast, and they do in large numbers. Some people initially come to stay, and some people don't, right? There is a circular pattern of people who go between the island. But one of the things that's so important to the book and the story is remembering both the politics and the people who came. Cigar workers were vehemently pro-independence, but they were also vehemently radically leftist, and they were unapologetic about it.
There was a lot of union organizing. From your description, there were great marches.
Exactly.
There were social aid groups that were very active. There were open debates in the community that seemed very lively and also very, very intelligent and deep. It was so interesting to hear about some of the history in the community there that in some ways, unfortunately, I guess, got absorbed into the greater Anglo community of greater Tampa at some point. So let's jump ahead a little bit, because we only have a few minutes left here on Between the Covers. Our literature quickie really moves fast. And again, Ybor City, Ybor, Crucible of the Latina South, author Sarah McNamara. I want to jump fast, way, way ahead, and I'm curious, reading your book, I almost wanted to take a road trip and go see.
You should. Come down. Left. I'm here now.
You're there. Okay. So what's left of Ybor City? Is it just swamped by Tampa, or is it still in many ways a somewhat unique place?
So what, Dave, what you were alluding to, right, it definitely was. It was this place of intellectualism and leftism. There were active anti-fascist movements. People were communists. They were socialists. They talked about it. It became the intellectual hub of the South with these different ideas, especially of an immigrant, you know, population. So when we're thinking about how Tampa is different from Miami, we're looking at a group of people who did, in fact, support Fidel Castro at one point. Some did. Others were rather ambivalent about him. But the reaction that you have in Miami doesn't exist here in the same way. And by the same token, one of the results is that Tampa has a Latino population with a different politic than what you find, at least the stereotype of Miami, which I would also argue is not unilaterally true, that we essentialize by not understanding what different migration patterns mean. But in Tampa, when we're thinking about what it is today, I mean, I do feel conflicted oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody who at least has lived outside of Florida since I was in graduate school, I went down the road. I was a graduate student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I've seen it's interesting how you can get perspective of how it's changed over time. So the historic community that was there, right, those that were my family members were from Ybor City. They worked in the cigar factories there. That community is no longer there. And I am, one of the things that I always remember was the first time that I was driven through Ybor, not as someone who was, well, going with my grandmother. I spent a lot of time there as a kid. There were businesses that were still open. I remember going to the Cuban jeweler with her. She believed that I wouldn't lose things if we went there, but that wasn't actually true. But, you know, driving through and she's telling me where different things were, and I must have been in middle school about, but I just looked at her at one point and I just said, well, where was your house? And I remember her eyes welling up with tears. And what she said was, it's where the interstate is now. And, you know, as a kid, like, you know, not to push it anymore. So I always think about that. I never asked anything else because I could tell that she looked upset. And, you know, as a kid, you're like, I upset her.
So it sounds like the story really of so many other minority communities around the country that what you're saying is over time it's sort of been destroyed is probably too strong a word, but cut up and
it definitely was. It was a target of urban renewal. And I will say right now that when I think of Ybor, I think of it as a place where, you know, perhaps it has always had affordable housing, even though the population has changed as who's living in there. I would say that it became a predominantly an African-American community over time. It became a community for people who worked in the arts who couldn't afford rent anywhere else in the city. It became a haven for people who were queer by the 1980s and 1990s. But today, especially in the midst of redevelopment, I think as an adult, it is one of the moments that I find rather depressing in some ways, and more so you're getting me in this moment in the last couple of weeks. Even within the last year, I see massive changes. Right. There is development in Ybor where they're building large luxury apartments, which I'm not sure who the heck is going to live in these.
Mm-hmm.
Those who have historically found Ybor as a place where they can be, I think it's becoming unlikely that they can afford to be there any longer. The city itself is becoming more expensive. But, I mean, a direct example of one of the things that really stood out to me is one of the results of urban renewal was that Ybor City became a place where there was a lot of public housing projects. And in part, those public housing projects were where people who had been cigar workers, where they lived later in life. But those housing projects have been there as long as I can remember. I came back 3 weeks ago and they are not only gone, they've been leveled. So this is between December and now, and there are now luxury apartments going up there.
Well, you know, Sarah, come on back to Chapel Hill and look at the apartments being built here. So we're about to wrap it up here on Between the Covers. Again, Ybor City, Y-B-O-R, Crucible of Latina South, UNC alumni Sarah McNamara talking about the history of Ybor City, leftist radicalism in the 30s, all sorts of interesting radical politics continuing, we hope, till today. Sarah, any last words for the Chapel Hill Carborough listening audience?
I like the part where you say a little bit today. If there's anything that I've noticed, especially when we're thinking about the different politics of Florida and the moment that we're all living in, since the book has come out, the one thing I can see is that the messages and especially the hope of those moments of resistance are certainly something that mobilize people who are still there. Some who are descendants and remember their parents being a part of these movements, but also people who are much younger. So if you're reading this book or reading any other and thinking of if other people are seeing what you're seeing, they are. And I hope you have those conversations, even if you feel like they might not be useful. People are listening.
Great thoughts for today. Again, this has been another edition of Between the Covers, a literature quickie on your community radio station, WCOM-LP 103.5, Chapel Hill, Ann Carver. This is your host, Tofu Dave. I'll be back at you next week with another quickie.